And I think Margaret's presentation opened up a lot of avenues, perhaps, that we hadn't been thinking about lately, or maybe just put squarely in front of us what we're dealing with most in the work that we do, in the life that we live. I'd like to build on a lot of the things that she said. I looked at the topic of today, what does it mean to be an aging religious today? And I thought, now who is that we're talking about? And as Anne Margaret said, they is us. And they is us, certainly. We've all been aging since 9 months before we were born. And we have been through a lifetime of developmental change, stages, growing. And each stage, we hope, with wisdom, age, and grace. And I'd like to talk a little bit more in detail about some of the developmental stages that lead us through life, because each one does build on the other. I have a chart up here that I put up for my own preservation whenever I do a program, and you probably can't see it from down there. It has to do with life stages, and I divide them differently: the child, young, middle-aged, older, and old. And I find since I created this chart, I'm wanting to extend middle-aged a little bit, but that's beside the point. At the top, I put dependent, independent, and dependent as part of a cycle of life. And at the bottom, I put child and adult as part of a cycle of life. And I think it's important to look at the top line and the bottom line. We somehow or other in later life, if we become frail enough, become dependent again after a lifetime of struggling to be independent. But we never cease to be adults. And I think we need to keep that squarely in our minds. When we are dealing with older people who have suffered some kinds of loss, having said that, I think I'll go back to earlier stages of life. Each stage has a unique challenge, a unique set of losses, a unique set of gains, and tasks peculiar to that stage of life. Each of us has responded uniquely to what life has offered. And I want to emphasize the uniqueness, as Anne Margaret did, to each individual's life and experience before I launch into generalizations, so that you realize that when I make a generalization, a lot of it isn't true for some people. Just to establish some background, healthy aging is related to a lifelong process. And the tasks that we needed to have completed earlier in life, first of all, I won't talk about birth. We all didn't have much to do with that. We got born. We got ejected into the world, and the task was difficult. It was accomplished. And we grew through the first 20 years of our lives, learning to come from that almost nothingness to a time of life when we would walk away from our support systems. Adolescence is a time when people leave their support systems, traditionally. If you've ever taught high school, and you know what goes on in high school kids, you know what they are doing is kicking over their old support systems, or trying to. And we all have had to do that at some stage of life. I find dealing with religious, especially religious women, many of them didn't accomplish the adolescent task of kicking over their early support systems. They went on to be good little girls and maybe good little boys. I don't know that much about religious men. Up until the time when they entered religion, they did not go through some of the stages that we see acted out around us. So that they went on living out of their parents' values and being conformists in many ways up until 1820 and on into religious life, where they found another set of very well-defined values to conform to. And they did that. We all did that. That was the name of the game in early religious life, when most of us looking around here were in formation. We conformed to other people's values. Something in us sometime or other, later on probably, and we saw the great upheaval of the 60s touching religious life, something had to happen that paralleled the task of adolescence. We had to say, these values came to us from other people, from our parents, from our church, from whatever. Are they in fact mine? Are they something I want to live out of? Am I going to embrace them? For many of us, it didn't happen until we were in our 40s. But the task of adolescence has to be done. One has to leave home, literally and figuratively, however that happened. And if you find someone who never, in quotes, left home in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, they are very dependent people. They need a reverend mother to tell them what to do next. There are not too many of them left in religious life after the great upheavals, but there are some, because the task of adolescence was never lived out for them. Very important adolescence. We find people who are constantly adolescent, but never quite make it over to the completion of the task of owning themselves and living out of their own centers and embracing the values that they want to live out of. Sometimes they are the same values they grew up with, but they've been examined and they've been owned. Sometimes they are the early values of religious life, but they've been examined and owned, not just taken from the outside. Okay, adolescence, very important to later life. 20-year-old person, persons in their 20s, not only in religious life, they have left home, usually, at least geographically, and the need to set up new networks, new affiliations, with most people, new families, is strong. With us, it was new bonds, new people that were in our lives, sometimes new authority figures, new peers, new people we worked with. We had to set up a network of support people. It was part of life, still is. We begin to establish our own identity and values if we have done the task of adolescence, to search out a new network of people, relationships, and also a new sense of what we are going to do with our lives every day. What's our work going to be? In our case, what's our ministry going to be? The task of the 20s is to get a hold on a lot of life that we're going to live out of for the rest of our lives. And we need to do that and accept responsibility for that. 30s? Some of you, well, nobody here in 30s? Maybe. It's a time of living out of the decisions of the 20s. It's a time of competence, time of finding out what you could do, time of whether you're going to be a good teacher, a good administrator, good whatever. Ministry is strong, career is strong out of religious life. We don't necessarily talk about ourselves having careers. We do more of that more lately. But the 30s, our developmental time for skills, relationships are solidified. People have children, not religious life usually, but normally in family life, it's a time for raising children, time for being other-centered in a way, time for giving oneself to one's work and one's call for us. Not a bad time, not a bad time. We hit the 40s, and 40s for some people are very traumatic, for other people not. We are as varied as that. But for many of us, especially in religious life, if we hit the 40s about the same time as there was a great upheaval in religious life. You remember the exodus from most of our congregations in the 40s? In the 60s, historically speaking. Many of those people were in their 40s. And they were asking, is this really what I want to do with my life? How did I get here? They were asking questions they hadn't been encouraged to ask before. And for many people, the answer was, I'm not living out of my own values. I'm living out of someone else's. I must go elsewhere. That's an oversimplification. I told you these were generalizations. But a lot of people in their 40s look at who they are and where they are and what they are and figure, this is it. I'm never going to be Mother Teresa of Calcutta. I'm never going to be Teresa of Avila. I'm never going to be Isaac Jogues. I'm never going to be whatever. I'm just going to be me, and these are my limitations, and these are my skills. It's a time to bite the bullet in one's 40s. Do I want to continue in this way? If you look at the outside world, there are a lot of divorces of people in their 40s. A lot of people rethink what their commitments of their 20s were. And if we have done this in religious life and rethought and re-owned and re-examined who we are and what we're doing, we're healthy. We're healthy. And we can go on from there, recommitted. And it has to happen at some point that we look at what we lived out of as younger people in our middle years and said, yes, I want to go on with this, or I need some changes in this. I need to reawaken myself, to re-enliven myself. Maybe I need to have another ministry. Maybe I need to examine more education. How many of you are in the first career that you ever had in religious life? One hand. Most of us have either re-examined where we were going or been re-examined by our congregations in ways that we had never expected. So we've made transitions and we've retooled. And usually that happens for a lot of people in their 40s. And it means sometimes a fresh start, sometimes a coming together of powers we never knew we had, sometimes just a realization of what our gifts really are. And if that happens in our 40s, it augurs well for our later years after that. So there's some questions, some life review. Some, what is this all about? Time that happens every once in a while. In their 20s, in their 40s, I haven't gotten to the 60s yet, wait for that. In the 50s, we often live out of what the 40s did for us. If we have taken a new direction, if we've gone back and gotten another degree, if we've gotten another job in the congregation, 50 is very often a fruitful time. It's a time of realization, however, that there may be some physical limitations, and I'll talk a little bit about physical limitations a little later on, that are going to slow us down a bit. We see the signs, we look around, the gray hair is there, the arm isn't long enough. I mean, things just happen. And by the 50s, we are coming to terms with that. But energies are still pretty good. We still are coming to maybe fruition, maybe a time when we really feel our sense of who we are and what our powers are. And this is not, it's not a bad time. How many of you, I won't even ask, how many of you in your 50s? How many have been there? How many have found it a good time? Maybe I should ask a question. Look at the age you are now and decide for yourself what's good about it. Got something good about it? Okay, tell your neighbor what's good about the age you are now. You may or may not reveal your age if you want to, but just tell her what's good about the age you are now. Okay. Must be a very good age. Something good about it. Okay? If I came in today and say, "My, you're looking much older today," would you feel flattered? I need to ask you another question. Considering the age you are now, how many of you would like to be 10 years younger at this very moment? Okay, I had 4 hands out of how many people? Of people? 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay. That's a high percentage. That's a high percentage. Most people have struggled so hard to get to the age where they are now that they don't want to give up a day. They don't want to go back. It's hard work, isn't it, living? Do you have a... There are times in life that we think we've handled as well as we could and we don't want to have to deal with them again. Is that true? And when we get to a certain level of, let's call it maturity, we have a pretty good sense of ourselves and we know who we are. Most of us wouldn't want to go ahead 10 years. I better ask that question. Anybody would want to be even 5 years older than you are? That's the average number of hands. None. So what are we saying? We are saying age is not an attractive prospect for us. However, getting back to my cycle of decades and the tasks of each decade, I got you through the 50s. Now I'd like to take you into the 60s, and I think one or two of us is there. The 60s is a time of life that can be all of the things that Anne Margaret put up, scary, for a lot of different reasons. What are the tasks of the 60s? People in their 60s. Well, you tell me. One is the reality that people are looking at us differently. People look at us when we get over a certain age as not quite the way they looked at us in our 40s and 50s. I don't know about your congregation. Look at our most congregations. Who are your power people? 40s, 50s. Anybody in their 60s and 70s in congregational government? Sometimes, yes. Sometimes. More likely, the power time is 40s and 50s. People have the energy for it, some of life experience. They're not discouraged. And people look at them as more competent than people that are in their 60s and 70s. And I'm not using that as a criticism, but simply an observation. That when people are older and have grayer hair, they are perceived differently by those who are younger. And I think that needs to be addressed in our congregations. I'm not on a crusade, I'm simply observing that. So, we have to kind of look at what the 60s go through. Usually, 60s find themselves with a little less energy than they had when they were 50 or 40 or 30. And there is a need to tool down. There is a need to look at one's daily schedule in life and see if, in fact, some changes are there. And that's something we take responsibility for more and more in religious life, that we see ourselves and maybe face an issue before it is faced for us by those in authority who see us as dwindling a little. We need to look at that. What happens when our past services no longer seem to be possible, or we don't have the energy for them, or if they're not needed, which has happened with many of us, some of the apostolates and missions that we had have passed out of existence. How many schools have closed? How many hospitals, etc.? Sometimes the work that we were fully engaged in just isn't there anymore. What happens when the individual religious finds apostolic, his or her, apostolic involvements no longer viable, either for reasons of health or energy level, or because the congregation doesn't need them anymore in the same sense, or the church doesn't need them anymore in the same job? I'm not saying the congregation or the church don't need them, but the perceived need for a particular job isn't there anymore. Or simply because younger people have moved into their jobs and are doing them. What needs to be done? And often, without the feeling, these younger people don't really feel the need to benefit from age and experience. They don't need to seek advice. They don't feel the need for that. They want to find their own way. What's happening to the person in their 60s, and we'll push this into 70s too, who has to face this as part of the circumstances of life? And it's a whole psychological kind of transition time that needs to be addressed, I think, in our congregations maybe a little more than it is. We are very conscious of the frail elderly. We are very conscious of infirmary needs, of skilled nursing needs. We take very good care of some of the diseased and the frail kinds of things that happen to our older sisters. What is the 70, 60, 70 age group going through? What are their pluses and minuses? What are their feelings? How do we get a handle on all that? I wouldn't be trying to worry about where my next ministry is going to be and how I'm going to be functioning in my old age. Someone would have told me. It would have been very simple. But the world isn't that way. And I've lived through too much upheaval, and so have you, and so have our older people in this century, ever to go back to the way things were. We have lived through, how many world wars have we lived through, if you consider the latest one? What's your war? Well, that's a good question. When I say, what were you doing during the war? What war is that? How many for World War I? Anybody? Okay. Anybody for World War II? Yeah. What about Vietnam? Is that your war? Okay. How about the Persian Gulf? That's all of our wars, really, right now, but most of us, when we talk about the war, have a different context. We came up at different times. We had different focus. And a lot of our values today have grown out of the times between the wars, and the economy between the wars, and the way we lived between the wars. If you grew up in the 20s and 30s, you're depression people. I mean economic depression people. You grew up saving things. You grew up eating soup. You grew up however. You know how you grew up. Things just didn't fall into your lap by the way they do for these young folks. You had grown up in a different economic picture. If you grew up between the Second World War and the Vietnamese War, things were easier. Everybody went to college. Education was flowing. Education was building. We were educators. We built with them. Remember those buildings we built? Wonderful. Lots of money. It seemed every house had to have all of the electrical appliances. We grew up with things between those two, between the Vietnamese War and the Second World War. Things loomed large. Everybody had a car. Everybody had a TV. Everybody went to, oh, you know, you were there, most of you. Vietnam shook the world apart. The 60s, never been the same since. So our people who have lived through the 60s and only the 60s have a whole different mindset about what it means to be a human being, what it means to live. We find this generation of people into ecology. Did you ever hear of ecology when you were growing up? We saved things because we needed them. We didn't save things because the world was going to fall apart. We had things between Vietnam and now, for instance, we never had before. And each time we had a decade, you can go through this a whole century in decades, we had a change in values, we had a change in outlook, and each one of us has lived through that. We are the great survivors of all time. No matter when you grew up, you have seen more change in this century than they saw in 2,000 years before altogether. And we are dealing with people in their 60s and 70s who have lived through all that, and in their 80s and 90s, for that matter, who have lived through and experienced and come to terms with and been able to live through a great deal. So we're not dealing with people who are psychologically fragile, unless, of course, there's an illness involved. We're dealing with people who can be tough, who can take what comes, who can take our addressing them. Okay, so you're in your 60s now. What's happening? Let's evaluate. Let's see. Where can you go? What can you do? We are not dealing with people who need to be told who they are and what they are. We're dealing with people who have a sense, or should have by now, a sense of who they are and what they're dealing with, and who can, we hope, since the last 20 years have been in religious life for most of us, a time of learning to communicate. We have some skills in communication. Remember the early 70s, all the workshops we had, and how to active listen to each other, and what did I think you say, and how can we sit down and talk with each other? Well, if we don't have the fruits of that in place by now, we better go back and do it again. Because we need people to take responsibility for themselves and to be able to articulate with the people whose job it is to run a congregation. But this is where I am. This is what seems like the best use of who I am, my gifts. And these are some of my limitations. And what can the congregation and I together do to keep some meaning in my life for the next 20 years? So we need to see congregations who see their older religious as rich resources, not just as problems. Oh, she's getting older. What shall we do with her? Oh, he can't do this anymore. That's the end for him. Can't be. So maybe he or she can't do this anymore. Okay, what can they do? And that kind of search is not only a congregational search, it's a personal search. But the congregation and the person need to come together and say, okay, what are the resources? What classes can I go to? What can I pick up? What skills do I need? On a personal note, for instance, I've been doing psychological counseling for 10 years or so for religious women, and tell you the truth, it gets to be a bit much after a while. I don't want to do it all day, every day. I want to do something else. But what do I want to do? I tell you, last summer I was thinking this through, and I'm not going to change my job right now, but down the line I'd like to get out of town and go someplace different and see another world. I used to teach English in high school. I used to do this and that with language. So language is here. So why don't I look into teaching English as a second language? There's a lot of need for that around. So I called around various schools, and no one was going to teach me how to teach English as a second language. There wasn't a course. So I enrolled myself with a whole bunch of Asians in a course at the community college that I could go to free, just to see how people do teach that. That's not going to cost my congregation any money. It's going to tell me whether or not I think I can really do it. And it's going to give me a freedom down the line not to stay stuck in one place doing one thing if I feel either I can't do it or I'm not doing it as well as I used to. So my individual responsibility has been to encourage that in myself, because I give these things all the time and I tell people to do that. So I thought, finally, listen to that voice that goes out and says all this good advice to people. And I think we need to do that with each other, to encourage each other at the 50s, 60s time of life, maybe even 70s, to retool if possible. Sometimes it costs money, sometimes it doesn't. Find out what to do, where your skills are, where your attractions are, maybe something you never did before. But the 60s can be a very freeing time for that. It's going to be transition in any case, and you have to face that. Most schools don't want you on their staffs, even if there's no set retirement. If they want you on their staffs, and sometimes they do, you'll be cut back in time. Fine. Okay. Energy. Some people stay in the school situation or hospital situation they've always been in. But they have to negotiate time, have to negotiate job, Okay. And usually, if the person herself or himself has enough sense of himself, that works. If they're cut back because everybody else knows they can't do the job, it's a whole other thing. So personal responsibility for the options in one's life. If they have been encouraged throughout, stand one in very good stead in the 60s, in the 70s. So how do we go from there? The congregation can encourage, can create the climate, can make it what normally happens in their dealings with their membership, that they sit down with someone regularly, annually if possible, and say, how are you? How are you doing? What's your job? Can you continue with it? Is it still fruitful? And that's just a very simple mechanism. Most of us do it. But the attitude has to be, look down the line a bit. Let's see if, in fact, this is where 5 years from now, 10 years from now, you'll want to be. Maybe you don't know. Maybe you don't know the needs of the church or where you'll be attracted. But the psychological effect of this is also your responsibility and we care. The two-way thing has a lot to do with healthy aging. The respect for the person, the respect for the uniqueness, the respect for their gifts, and the desire to continue in ministry. Most of us are very well-intentioned. Most of us want to be needed. Most of us want to have the feeling that the work that we do has meaning for someone. Freud says that mental health, he didn't use that term, is based on your work life and your love life. Your work life, for us, is ministry of some kind. If, in fact, we get to an infirm stage, it's different. Our work life becomes our prayer life, maybe. But our love life, for us, too, is important. What happens in your 60s and 70s, and sometimes in your 50s? Very often, you suffer severe losses, personal losses. By the time you're 60, and certainly by the time you're 70, you probably have lost your parents. Now, for religious people, that's a lot of one's family to lose. They are the significant members of your family. We don't have husbands, we don't have children. We have brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, maybe. But our parents are special, and when we lose them, we lose something. So we have that loss by the time we're 60s, certainly. At least one or both parents. If not, we are very often caught up with the care for aging parents, which is a whole other middle life thing that a lot of religious people go through. How does one care for an aging mother or father and carry on a full-time ministry? I have a whole workshop I give on that one, because it has become such a pattern in so many of our religious lives. What is our responsibility? What is our congregation's responsibility? What are our family options? What do we do when we lose people that we really care about, and when we feel we should be taken care of them, all the guilt things that go with that whole psychological profile that is special to people in religious life whose main family connection has been through parents. So when the parents are lost for one reason or another, it's a piece of life that isn't there anymore. How do we react to losses? How do we react to, and how have we reacted in religious life, to being uprooted and taken out of our support systems? Most of us have had one or two or five or 10 or 20 changes, as we used to call them, in our lives. We have had to come away from our support systems. In our 50s, 60s, and 70s, we're most likely going to leave our support systems. And our support systems are sometimes the sisters with our brothers or religious with who we live. How many times have you changed community and left a community that supported you and had to go with a community that you didn't know and had to make new connections? How many of you have left a parish or a job or a faculty or a group of people? We've all done it. We've had losses. We've had human losses. We've reacted in different ways. Some people are very good at starting all over again and rebuilding systems. Some people just aren't. They're shyer, they don't do it as easily. It's very painful. It's a transition that has a lot of tension built into it. And it very often happens in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. How do we help people to deal with that? How do we understand that about ourselves? How do we see people coping with that? How do we reach out to or make possible other networking kinds of things in our congregations? How do we keep people in touch with people of other ages in their congregations? A lot of us get into the little living group that we have. We work very hard. We build community. You know community that we build right there? It's good. It's warm. It's good. It's supporting. And what happens when we leave that context? Questions to be asked. How do we start over and over again to make meaning, human connections that have meaning? How do we start that? We're going to lose our friends. How do you like that? We do lose our friends. How many friends have we lost in religious life? You can make a list, couldn't you? Yeah. And what did we put in their place? Nobody? If we keep bringing people into our lives, on every level, it doesn't have to be deep, intimate relationships. If we keep bringing people into our lives in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, we have people that we can relate to. If we have had one set of friends, the group we entered with, for instance, we get to be 60 and 70, and we have always kind of kept with those people, we're going to be very lonely in our old age. So part of significant successful aging is openness to new relationships, a willingness to go out of one's way. It takes energy. It takes risking the hurt that comes when those particular kinds of relationships have to end and we move on to other ones. So the 50s, 60s, and 70s are fraught with that kind of tension, that kind of difficulty, or that kind of opportunity, if you want to look at it. New friends are an opportunity, but you do get tired of losing and gaining and losing and gaining. So I see people going this way. They've lost a few. So we lose our parents. We often lose our friends. And in the 60s and 70s, we begin to lose brothers and sisters. And believe me, that's a shock. When someone younger, for instance, goes out of our lives or dies or whatever, that's hard. That's real hard. And what provision and community do we have for talking about that? I'd like to talk before I move into, better move into it soon, some of the physical things. I'd like to talk about depression. Depression is a recognizable, clinical difficulty. And there are several kinds of it. Depression can come at any age, and it is treatable. It's reversible and treatable. Some people have gone through life with a low-level depression that was never diagnosed and never treated, and you know them. Their mouths go like this, and they've been like that all their lives. They are dark-siders, and they've lived that way. But for most people who have persevered, we've learned how to handle some of the ups and downs of life. But for some people in their 60s, 70s, and sometimes 80s, we see that the losses of life have been so cumulative, and maybe even a specific grieving incident has been so severe that it takes quite a while to get over, to act out, to work through the grieving process. And the grieving process is something we should not block. If you lose someone you really care about through death or whatever, you have a right to grieve. And for someone who is very special to us, you have a right to grieve for a while. It's not just a 24-hour thing or until the funeral is over. There's going to be depression among us, and that's reactive depression. And by and large, there are support systems and people and peer counseling and that kind of thing can help us through that time. Good friends help. And you can recognize that other people certainly, that there have been times when you've been very helpful to them or they've been helpful to you. And the kind of peer thing that happens among us is very supportive in time of real tragedy in our lives. And I encourage us all to give that kind of support. But you also have to realize that there is sometimes a long-term kind of thing. And it's not going to be over in 5 minutes. In the books, they say if someone loses a spouse, expect them to grieve for a year. That's a while. And we don't say that about ourselves. We say if you lose somebody important, grieve for a little while, then say your prayers and go on. Faith will sustain you. the psychological process is still there. We still grieve. We still have to go through certain of the stages of grieving, which is a whole other kind of thing. But we need to know that we are that way, that this is part of the human condition, and that it's all right for people to grieve. And that it's going to slow us down sometimes, but it's not the end. It's actually a time-limited process. If it goes on beyond and is so severe that a person is not functional, then you need professional help. And I'd like to say a word about mental problems in older people and the fact that some of them are reversible. And that with some professional help, a lot of our older people could be functioning at a much higher level. I'm going to jump for a little bit. If you find an older person, 70s, 80s, who seems to be confused, who seems not to remember things, you think to yourself, ah, Alzheimer's, ah, they're losing it, ah, they're too old. What can you do? What can you check out? Medicine. Check out whatever medication they've been on for X number of years, whatever new medication somebody gave them, whether they're taking all the medications that have been prescribed for them since they were 20 and lumping them together. Sometimes all they need is to stop taking medication or to have it reevaluated. First thing to check out is what medications they're on. Second thing to check out is hearing. A lot of our people deny a hearing loss. I don't know what it is about having a hearing loss that's so disgraceful. Well, I have two people in the house where I live who have obvious hearing losses. I took one to have her hearing tested, and he said, yes, you need hearing aids. End of the event. Never went back. The other one won't even go. These are people in their 70s. They're active, and their ministries are okay right now. But they're getting worse. They're not going to get better. This is not a reversible thing with them. And they're getting to be a little bit of a drag in community. You've got to say it over again. You've got to be sure they hear. I had a conversation with one of them a couple of Sundays ago. We were watching the Open in Augusta, the Golf Open. And I got in there toward the end of it, and Ian, what's his name, was ahead. So my friend said to me, he's Dutch. And I had just read the paper, and he was Welsh. I knew that. And then she said to me, Tom Watson has won the Green Jacket, which is the championship, 10 times. I had just read the paper, and that wasn't true. He had won it 10 years ago. And they were just picking up enough information to have misinformation about what was going on. It's not funny, because it looks as if they're confused. It looks as if they're not with it. And this lady is very sharp, but she's just not hearing. And she's getting that way in community. I know someone she turns off because her voice is soft. She never hears what that person says, and she just looks straight ahead and has a little smile on her face when that person talks. She could benefit by very light hearing aid. Her loss isn't severe. But something in her. Her mother and father were deaf when they were 90. Certainly the history is there. What is it about anybody of any age who doesn't want to admit that they are not hearing and are presenting themselves as either confused or vague or forgetting in ways that are certainly not healthy? So one of my big pitches, it's a crusade I have, is to make it part of what congregations ask their people to get a physical regularly. And part of that physical should be a hearing test. You go to the eye doctor. How often? No shame. We wear glasses. What's the shame with having a hearing loss and not being able to live fully a community life and eventually not being able to do ministry? What's the shame in having an annual evaluation of hearing? And Christian Brothers, bless their hearts, also help to provide hearing aids. Plug for Christian Brothers. Because Medicare doesn't. Some of the other services don't. Some of the things that make it impossible, some of the physical things that are normal and age-related and whatever, make it impossible for people to continue in optimal living situations are reversible or can be compensated for. and Margaret mentioned that a lot of our older people want to stay in housing that is small, not institutional. And how can we make that happen without having a big deal about it? Lots of little ways. And if you have someone in your congregation, maybe you can train them up to make a survey and go around the houses and see what can be done. Or just the idea of where the railings are. If you have railings on your steps, somebody can live there who couldn't live there if there weren't railings. I have a friend whose leg was amputated. She's in her 50s now. When she comes to our house, she has a hard time in her bathrooms. So she was staying at our house for years. She went out and she got some of those bars that you hang on the wall. And now she can use our bathroom because there are these things to help her up and down when she's not wearing her artificial leg. We didn't know that. She did. There are things you can do. I have an older woman who called to say, please call the heating company. This place is freezing. The thing must be broken. I went over to check it out. The thermostat was turned down to 50. She couldn't quite see those little numbers. She didn't know the thermostat was down to 50. So if you just put a little tape where it says 70 and a little tape here, you can make those tapes match. Little tiny things that can keep people living in situations. If you have a stove, get an expert in your community. If you have a stove where you have a gas stove and the controls are back here, somebody can burn to death just turning the thing off. Have the controls here, easy enough. Big controls so you can see. All kinds of things. You can put a little gadget on your phone to turn it up and down. They can hear. I tell you, a little creativity. And people can be, without a lot of problem, maintained in communities. Transportation's another thing. But the kind of help we can give to people. When they begin to suffer, some just the natural attrition of physical loss. A lot of people have a little experimental program to see what would happen to people if they worked out lightly on the machines that people younger than they were working out heavily on. And he found muscles tone, skin tone, all kinds of good things coming. One woman of 82 was swimming laps every day of all kinds of things. So part of keeping our people healthy and keeping ourselves healthy is to look at the normal things that can be done to keep people in a situation. I'm getting a signal back there from my friend. I have a lot more to say and I haven't time to say it, but how about some comments and questions? Anything on that? Comment is, it's lunchtime. Yes, sister.
I have a concern about checking the nutritional state. I find that a lot of our sisters, because we were served for many years, or because of the incapacity that comes with aging, our lack of training, don't know much about nutritional status. Would you like to comment a little bit about that? And perhaps, I'm not competent sufficiently to do that, but I have concerns about nutritional concerns.
I think your concerns are well-founded. A lot of our people who grew older in more institutional settings where they didn't have to cook or plan meals found themselves in smaller settings where they were not given to balanced diets. I don't think our diets in the past were terribly well-balanced either. I think enough is being said by doctors to people about nutritional things. And our house has gone crazy on nutrition now because two or three people suffered from things that needed to be addressed. And the education has come through the fact that we needed it. I've listened to nutritionists for years, and they go through here and out here because I didn't want to hear them. I mean, that's denial on my part. But now I see that because someone I care about needs it, we're making adjustments in the nutritional kinds of things we serve in our house. I think we can educate and educate and educate. I think there's nobody in this God's world who hasn't heard of cholesterol, who hasn't heard of the problems that come from fried foods, from butter, from all the ice cream, terrible. I don't know how we can address the fact that nutrition has an awful lot to do with the way we age. Until someone we care about has a problem. I think that's what leads us to it. Until we have a problem, maybe. Maybe. Well, the hope is we care enough about ourselves to do something about it. But part of the workshop that Ann Margaret and I do sometimes for the third age has a little nutrition piece to it. And we give it, and one of our people is a nutritionist, and she gives it in great detail. I don't know who hears it, and I don't know what happens. What are we going to have for lunch today? Okay, come back after lunch and report on the nutritional value of whatever it was you ate. And you'll know the nutritional value. You'll know it up here. But you also know what you're hungry for, and you know what you'll eat. So I don't know how to address that problem. Anything else?
And I have a question. The sisters have no problem getting medical help for a physical problem. However, I find that sometimes when we do have sisters in, active senior living environments, they do have difficulty getting help for emotional problems. How do you address this to a senior sister?
Is your question how does...
How would you approach her? I mean, you do ask her, but you don't get her to go. They refuse. My experience is that they refuse.
A lot depends on how that's addressed and who addresses it and in what way it's addressed. I know for instance, a drinking problem, if that's something, there's a whole intervention kind of a process that can work. And I also see that the sisters in community who, if in fact they genuinely love this person, can come together in an intervention with the authority figure who's brought in to handle this case, which is the horrible thing that sometimes happens, to show that there is a need, people care, and these are the options. Not will you, but these are the options. This is someone you can see, this is someone you can see, this is something you can do. I think sometimes if it's severe enough, you have to do it that way. It's hard for someone, especially an older person, but it also means you've checked out some of the things we talked about, medication that they're taking and whatever the reactive depression situation might be. You have to check out a lot of things. It's very delicate. Nobody likes to be told they need help, whatever those terms are. Yeah. Yes.
Sister Ann, I'm Vance Pastorius at Cabochon from Pittsburgh. You have mentioned depression in the life of elderly religious. I'm feeling in my own task as a guardian and a man who takes care of elderly religious, is anger a problem with them and with us? And does it interfere with our happiness and satisfaction in our senior years?
Anger can very well be a problem. And most people feel depression is a form of anger that's gone internalized in some ways. Depending on the history of the individual, which everything does, anger is a result of unresolved conflict, of unresolved tension in the past. And for most of our people in their 70s and 80s, the way to handle anger was to sit on it, to forget it. They were raised to say, now, if you can't be nice to people, go to your room until you can come out and behave yourself. So that anger was never dealt with. And it's the work of the world for people in their 70s and 80s to come to, first of all, a realization that, A, they are angry, and B, what they're angry about. It can be done. And sometimes psychiatric help is the only answer. And sometimes that's not the answer either. But certainly the offer of it, I know one sister who had a long, long history of anxiety and medication and institutionalization actually for a while. And in her 70s, she was seeing someone and finally came to admit to the fact that when she was 13, she'd been abused by her brother. It had taken her 60 years to be able to address that, to get some of that anger out, and the guilt out that went with it. A lot of anger is guilt. You made me feel guilty about part of my life. it's possible to help people deal with it. And professional help is sometimes the answer. The other piece of dealing with older religious who seem to be angry is just to listen to them with respect, not trying to argue that they have no right to be angry. Maybe they have a right to be angry. Maybe the anger was justified way back when. But to somehow bring into the present day circumstances that this isn't what's happening anymore, that life is different now. That was then, and it was a shame and too bad, whatever. But this is now, and let's live now. I mean, that's simplistic, but sometimes professional help is needed. Anything else? Let's have lunch. See you at 1:30. And the desire to continue in ministry. Most of us are very well intentioned. Most of us want to be needed. Most of us want to have the feeling that the work that we do has meaning for someone. Freud says that mental health, he didn't use that term, is based on your work life and your love life. Your work life for us is ministry of some kind. If, in fact, we get to an infirm stage, it's different. Our work life becomes our prayer life, maybe. But our love life for us, too, is important. What happens in your 60s and 70s, and sometimes in your 50s? Very often you suffer severe losses, personal losses. By the time you're 60, and certainly by the time you're 70, you probably have lost your parents. Now, for religious people, that's a lot of one's family to lose. They are the significant members of your family. We don't have husbands, we don't have children, we have brothers and sisters, nieces and nephews, maybe. But our parents are special, and when we lose them, we lose something. So we have that loss by the time we're 60s, certainly. At least one or both parents. If not, we are very often caught up with the care for aging parents, which is a whole other middle life thing that a lot of religious people go through. How does one care for an aging mother or father and carry on a full-time ministry? I have a whole workshop I give on that one, because it has become such a pattern in so many of our religious lives. What is our responsibility? What is our congregation's responsibility? What are our family options? What do we do when we lose people that we really care about and when we feel we should be taken care of them? All the guilt things that go with that whole psychological profile. That is special to people in religious life whose main family connection has been through parents. So when the parents are lost for one reason or another, it's a piece of life that isn't there anymore. How do we react to losses? How do we react to, and how have we reacted in religious life, to being uprooted and taken out of our support systems? Most of us have had one or two or five or 10 or 20 changes, as we used to call them, in our lives. We have had to come away from our support systems. In our 50s, 60s, and 70s, we're most likely going to leave our support systems. And our support systems are sometimes the sisters with our brothers or religious with whom we live. How many times have you changed community and left a community that supported you and had to go with a community that you didn't know and had to make new connections? How many of you have left a parish or a job or a faculty or a group of people? We've all done it. We've had losses. We've had human losses. We've reacted in different ways. Some people are very good at starting all over again and rebuilding systems. Some people just aren't. They're shyer. They don't do it as easily. It's very painful. It's a transition that has a lot of tension built into it. And it very often happens in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. How do we help people to deal with that? How do we understand that about ourselves? How do we see people coping with that? How do we reach out to or make possible other networking kinds of things in our congregations? How do we keep people in touch with people of other ages in their congregations? a lot of us get into the little living group that we have. We work very hard. We build community. You know community that we build right there? It's good. It's warm. It's good. It's supporting. And what happens when we leave that context? Questions to be asked. How do we start over and over again to make meaning, human connections that have meaning? How do we start that? We're going to lose our friends. How do you like that? We do lose our friends. How many friends have we lost in religious life? You can make a list, couldn't you? Yeah. And what did we put in their place? Nobody? If we keep bringing people into our lives, on every level, it doesn't have to be deep, intimate relationships. If we keep bringing people into our lives in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, we have people that we can relate to. If we have had one set of friends, the group we entered with, for instance, we get to be 60 and 70, and we have always kind of kept with those people, we're going to be very lonely in our old age. So part of significant successful aging is openness to new relationships. A willingness to go out of one's way. It takes energy. It takes risking the hurt that comes when those particular kind of relationships have to end and we move on to other ones. So the 50s, 60s, and 70s are fraught with that kind of tension, that kind of difficulty, or that kind of opportunity, if you want to look at it. New friends are an opportunity, but you do get tired of losing and gaining and losing and gaining. So I see people going this way. They've lost a few. So we lose our parents. We often lose our friends. And in the 60s and 70s, we begin to lose brothers and sisters. And believe me, that's a shock. When someone younger, for instance, goes out of our lives or dies or whatever, that's hard. That's real hard. And what provision in community do we have for talking about that? I'd like to talk before I move into, better move into it soon, some of the physical things. I'd like to talk about depression. Depression is a recognizable clinical difficulty, and there are several kinds of it. Depression can come at any age, and it is treatable. It's reversible and treatable. Some people have gone through life with a low-level depression that was never diagnosed and never treated, and you know them. Their mouths go like this, and they've been like that all their lives. They are dark-siders, and they've lived that way. But for most people who have persevered, we've learned how to handle some of the ups and downs of life. But for some people in their 60s, 70s, and sometimes 80s, we see that the losses of life have been so cumulative, and maybe even a specific grieving incident has been so severe that it takes quite a while to get over, to act out, to work through the grieving process. And the grieving process is something we should not block. If you lose someone you really care about through death or whatever, you have a right to grieve. And for someone who is special to us, you have a right to grieve for a while. It's not just a 24-hour thing or until a funeral is over. There's going to be depression among us, and that's reactive depression. And by and large, there are support systems and people and peer counseling and that kind of thing can help us through that time. Good friends help. And you can recognize in other people, certainly, that there have been times when you've been very helpful to them and they've been helpful to you. And the kind of peer thing that happens among us is very supportive in time of real tragedy in our lives. And I encourage us all to give that kind of support. But you also have to realize that there is sometimes a long-term kind of thing. And that's not going to be over in 5 minutes. In the books, they say if someone loses a spouse, expect them to grieve for a year. That's a while. And we don't say that about ourselves. We say if you lose somebody important, grieve for a little while, then say your prayers and go on. Faith will sustain you. The psychological process is still there. We still grieve. We still have to go through certain of the stages of grieving, which is a whole other kind of thing. But we need to know that we are that way, that this is part of the human condition, and that it's all right for people to grieve. And that it's going to slow us down sometimes, but it's not the end. It's actually a time-limited process. If it goes on beyond and is so severe that a person is not functional, then you need professional help. And I'd like to say a word about mental problems in older people and the fact that some of them are reversible. And that with some professional help, a lot of our older people could be functioning at a much higher level. I'm going to jump for a little bit. If you find an older person, 70s, 80s, who seems to be confused, who seems not to remember things, you think to yourself, Alzheimer's, they're losing it, they're too old. What can you do? What can you check out? Medicine. Check out whatever medication they've been on for X number of years, whatever new medication somebody gave them, whether they're taking all the medications that have been prescribed for them since they were 20 and lumping them together. Sometimes all they need is to stop taking medication or to have it reevaluated. First thing to check out is what medications they're on. Second thing to check out is hearing. A lot of our people deny a hearing loss. I don't know what it is about having a hearing loss that's so disgraceful. Well, I have two people in the house where I live who have obvious hearing losses. I took one to have her hearing tested, and he said, yes, you need hearing aids. End of the event. Never went back. The other one won't even go. These are people in their 70s. They're active, and their ministries are okay right now. But they're getting worse. They're not going to get better. This is not a reversible thing with them. And they're getting to be a little bit of a drag in community. You've got to say it over again. You've got to be sure they hear. I had a conversation with one of them a couple of Sundays ago. We were watching the Open in Augusta, the Golf Open. And I got in there toward the end of it, and Ian, what's his name, was ahead. So my friend said to me, he's Dutch. And I had just read the paper, and he was Welsh. I knew that. And then she said to me, Tom Watson has won the Green Jacket, which is the championship, 10 times. I had just read the paper, and that wasn't true. He had won it 10 years ago. And they were just picking up enough information to have misinformation about what was going on. It's not funny, because it looks as if they're confused. It looks as if they're not with it. And this lady is very sharp, but she's just not hearing. And she's getting that way in community. I know someone she turns off because her voice is soft. She never hears what that person says, and she just looks straight ahead and has a little smile on her face when that person talks. She could benefit by very light hearing aid. Her loss isn't severe. But she, something in her, her mother and father were deaf when they were 90. Certainly the history is there. What is it about anybody of any age who doesn't want to admit that they are not hearing and are presenting themselves as either confused or vague or forgetting in ways that are certainly not healthy? So one of my big pitches, it's a crusade I have, is to make it part of what congregations ask their people, to get a physical regularly. And part of that physical should be a hearing test. You go to the eye doctor, how often? No shame, we wear glasses. What's the shame with having a hearing loss and not being able to live fully a community life and eventually not being able to do ministry? What's the shame in having an annual evaluation of hearing? And Christian Brothers, bless their hearts, also help to provide hearing aids. Plug for Christian Brothers. Because Medicare doesn't. Some of the other services don't. Some of the things that make it impossible, some of the physical things that are normal and age-related and whatever, make it impossible for people to continue in optimal living situations, are reversible or can be compensated for. And Margaret mentioned that a lot of our older people want to stay in housing that is small, not institutional. And how can we make that happen without having a big deal about it? lots of little ways. And if you have someone in your congregation, maybe you can train them up to make a survey and go around the houses and see what can be done. Or just the idea of where the railings are. If you have railings on your steps, somebody can live there who couldn't live there if there weren't railings. I have a friend whose leg was amputated. She's in her 50s now. When she comes to our house, she has a hard time in her bathrooms. So she was staying at our house for years. She went out and she got some of those bars that you hang on the wall. And now she can use our bathroom because there are these things to help her up and down when she's not wearing her artificial leg. We didn't know that. She did. There are things you can do. I have an older woman who called to say, please call the heating company. This place is freezing. The thing must be broken. I went over to check it out. The thermostat was turned down to 50. But she couldn't quite see those little numbers. And she didn't know the thermostat was down to 50. So if you just put a little tape where it says 70 and a little tape here, you can make those tapes match. Little tiny things that can keep people living in situations. If you have a stove, get an expert in your community. If you have a stove where you have a gas stove and the controls are back here, somebody can burn to death just turning the thing off. Have the controls here, easy enough. Big controls so you can see. All kinds of things. You can put a little gadget on your phone to turn it up and down, if they can hear. I tell you, a little creativity. And people can be, without a lot of problem, maintained in communities. Transportation's another thing. But the kind of help we can give to people. When they begin to suffer, some of just the natural attrition of physical loss.